This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show here, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, you told me you were going to change before we recorded, but I see that you're still wearing those pants that you ripped.
That's true, Chris. I did not get a chance to change that. I wasn't going to change that. I just decided that going to be doing the show is Matthew McConaughey, so it might take a while for us to record because everything's going to be a lot slower and a lot more in depth.
All right. Well, see, I was going to say with the ripped pants, now we're really in trouble. But if you're going to do the show as McConaughey, now I know we're doubly in trouble.
Chris, I don't like to think of it like that. I think it's going to be fine. We just need to sit back and relax.
We need a special show where, instead of us hosting The Orb, it's Matthew McConaughey and Christopher Walken.
Oh, God, that would be... can you imagine a show with Christopher Walken? I can't even... I mean, that voice is really hard to do, so I can't even...
Yeah, I'm not going to try to do it. They should have the Walken cast.
The Walken cast, that would be...
The Walken cast.
The Walken cast. Yeah. I'd listen to it, you know, I mean...
I would too,
I got a fever. A fever whose only prescription is more podcasting.
I gotta have more podcasting.
Gotta have more podcasting. Yeah, it would be... And they could have William Shatner just visit every once in a while, you know? And then,
that would be awesome.
Can you imagine the comedic gold that would happen? Chris, why are we not selling this idea to them?
I don't know. And I think the listeners are wondering, why aren't you guys talking about Deep Space Nine?
yeah.
But actually, this is a setup gone off the tracks for us here on The Orb. We're going to be talking about Rocks and Shoals today. And of course, Miles O'Brien rips his pants at the beginning.
Wait, Chris, are you talking about my... That's just my shampoo.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, Rocks and Shoals. It's the most popular shampoo in the Dominion. You need it when you're a Jim Hadar.
I can tell you, it controls dandruff better than anything else. I mean, and that's a really big problem for Jim Hadar, so... Yeah. I gotta say, it's
great.
Well,
also, you know, remember, dandruff is a big problem because Vorta, they're very flaky.
Yeah, they are. Wow, we are really, really laying it on thick.
We really are. I think we should just get into the discussion here. So this is the third part of our seven-part series on the Dominion Invasion arc, or the Dominion Occupation arc, which starts the sixth season of Deep Space Nine, and it's the third part because we started this off with Call to Arms at the end of season five. So this is the second episode of season six here, Rocks and Shoals. And Matthew, this episode, my first thought in watching this at the beginning was that there's this sense of danger in this episode that is really different than what we got earlier on in, even in DS9, I think, but especially if you think back to The Next Generation and when our crew would be in danger. the stakes here are just so much higher.
Well, and you know that they are because O'Brien is walking around cursing like a sailor. I mean, Right. Get this damn thing done, and why the hell isn't this working? And Nog is yelling back, because I can't damn fix it. And, you know, he's getting told to watch his language, so...
I even have in my notes, damn, they're in danger.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a really interesting thing that they do in this episode, because... It can seem, I think, maybe out of place that how does this fit with this whole invasion arc, but I love that they're taking the time to really show how this war is already affecting our characters, you know, and the amount of stress that they're under and how they deal with it. And so at the very beginning of this episode, we are in a horrible situation and the sense of danger is very real. And yet at the same time, and how they're dealing with it is to yell at each other, you know, and everybody can tell they're not really yelling at each other. It's the frustration. But then later on, we deal with it with humor. And so it's just a really interesting thing, just kind of them subtly showing, okay, what is it like to be in this kind of stressful situation and what are the things that you do to cope with it?
And maybe they were also just very frustrated and stressed by the heat in that quarry when they shot this episode, because apparently it was up around 110 or more Fahrenheit.
I can't imagine, because, you know, that part of California in the summer, it can just be deadly with heat. And I can understand, being from Texas, you know, and especially near the water, it's probably a little humid too. So it's... I can't imagine being in those wool uniforms. No wonder, you know, they were taking them off. You know, again, when you unzip the turtleneck, you know that it's a bad day. And
then you know it's serious.
Yeah, you know it's serious.
Yeah. I'm not sure how much water. This is like a rock quarry in Sun Valley, north of LA, and most of that ocean was put in post. So, like, the foreground water is actually there. So I'm not sure how humid it really is there, but still just incredibly hot. So maybe they were feeling a bit stressed from that. And yeah, so, but they're really in danger here. Like, there's no easy fix. That's one thing that stands out to me, because usually in Star Trek, you know, you can kind of see how they're going to get out of something. But when you're stranded on a planet in a dark matter nebula, trying to think back here, was it 17 years from Federation space that we heard at the end of A Time to Stand?
Yeah, they're pretty far. I mean, it's not Voyager far, but it's still, I mean, there's not a good way for them to get home.
Right. Like we said last time, the war will be over by the time they get home. if they can't find a way to get there faster. So the stakes are extremely high, and we really don't know how they're going to get out of the situation. And we know how deadly the Jem'Hadar are. And you initially think, right, the odds are stacked against our heroes, because, and as we're going to talk about today some, I think, as well, ethics of war, our side is less inclined to take the necessary steps to protect themselves against an enemy like the Jem'Hadar, who would just simply be ruthless.
It's a really interesting, I think, dichotomy to the other series that had preceded this, you know, TNG and TOS. You know, the only situation that I can really remember feeling this dire was when the Enterprise, Kirk blew it up.
In search for Spock.
And for a while there in the film, you don't know how they're going to get out. I mean, they just blew up their home. They just destroyed, you know, everything.
Yeah, they wrecked their ride, man.
They wrecked their ride, Chris. And, you know, Kirk apparently wasn't trekking himself before he wrecked himself. This reminds me, though, of that situation where they're doing everything they can to stay alive, and at the same time, none of the options really open to them are good. But I just never feel like we really got that a ton in TNG. We always knew they were going to find a way to pull it out, unless you're Tasha Yar, and then you're just, you know, slimed. So But yeah, it is an interesting thing, especially the way this episode starts with that foreboding sense. And we crash on a planet. We have no idea how we're going to get out of this. Dax is hurt. I mean, there's a possibility of her dying. And we know Deep Space Nine already, and we know that it's taking a different path. So, you know, I remember watching this for the first time and thinking, holy bleep, what's going to happen?
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of Terry Farrell, Jadzia being injured in this episode, you know, the reason she's injured is that apparently Terry Farrell had some skin condition and she couldn't be exposed to the bright sunlight of the quarry, so they wrote the story that she is injured. But that just reminds me of the other thing about this episode that really stands out to me is how unique it is in that, especially on Deep Space Nine, seeing an episode being shot outdoors, because we're so often in these tight corridors of the station, seeing something shot outdoors is always unique and interesting, but being shot in bright sunlight like this, we get that a few times, like with the ship or with the Children of Time a little bit, but here especially, when this first aired, I remember thinking how odd this episode seemed because of that. And even today when I watch it, it just really stands out amongst the series.
It is really, and I think it's a unique episode for Deep Space Nine in that sense, and it just makes it special that they're pushing those boundaries with this, you know, arc here. You know, they're really not taking the easy way out, and I think that that's really, really neat to see the fact that the writers of the show and the showrunners were willing to take a risk by telling a story like this. And like you said, you know, going outdoors, location shoot, it's expensive. It takes a lot of work. You know, you're at the mercy of the weather and all of that. To really, I think, ramp up the danger here for these characters. And what better way to do it than have a story like this, you know, that they have crash landed on the planet and there is a good chance that they may never make it back. Obviously, we can't suspend our disbelief that long because they're not going to kill off that many of the main cast.
Right. The entire main cast has been
killed. Yeah, exactly. We're just going to replace them. This is now going to be the Jake show.
The Jake show, yeah. And it's kind of like Murphy Brown. They're in a newsroom, but it's Jake.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to be like the Walter Cronkite of the Star Trek universe. We just didn't know it yet.
But the other thing this does, too, is within this war storyline, it adds an element of realism to it as well. Because one problem with warfare in Star Trek and in a lot of science fiction is that it's fought starship to starship, right? You don't actually come face to face with your enemy as often as you would in a traditional war scenario, and certainly not outside where you're actually in the elements. And that's what we get here. And also in the Siege of AR-558, we get that too, but that's dark. You know, we don't have the bright sunlight. It just adds an element of realism to it, though. It shows that they're really involved in an actual conflict here. And it's more than just the traditional Star Trek, you know, space battle scenario.
Well, and I think, too, we're learning, especially with this episode and with this series, that Deep Space Nine is going to take that different look, the reality of what the situation is like, and that warfare really doesn't just happen on some sort of, you know, ship-to-ship battle, that, you know, you do have to get down and dirty when you're fighting a war, and there's going to be ground battles, and Deep Space Nine doesn't shy away from going all Apocalypse Now on us, you know, mm-hmm, when they need to. So just like you mentioned, Chris, that just, I think they really are going for broke when it comes to what they're willing to do in this show to just kind of break that mold. And we've talked a lot about it before, but I think what they're doing is they really are putting to the test these people who are supposed to kind of be these enlightened, perfect styled humans.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah,
when you come up against the brutality of something like a real war, what does it look like? Because we've already seen, one of the things is with Deep Space Nine, the fact that, you know, Miles with the Cardassians, in that he's had this brutal war with them, and it's taken him a very long time to get where he is in relation to the Cardassian people. And we're about to put all of the entire Alpha Quadrant through this with this war against the Dominion. And so, I think it's a really bold thing for Star Trek to have done. And again, I think it's just that thing that really is setting Deep Space Nine apart from the other shows in a very good way, especially when right before this was TNG. So that when you're watching the shows, it doesn't just feel like we're copying. No, we're just building off what they did there.
Yeah, it has its own unique character. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, when Miles was walking across the quarry with the phaser rifle in his hands, my thought was, he's thinking, oh, here we go again. Right, fighting the Cardassians, and now he's going to face off against the Jem'Hadar. Here he is in another situation like he had experienced, which we don't get to see on the show, but we know his back history with the Cardassians. Well, here's something, Matthew, talking about reality here, facing reality. There's the scene in this episode where Kira and Odo are talking to Jake, and Jake is asking these questions because he's trying to write another piece for the news service, which, of course, are not being broadcast out, but he's hoping they will be. But what struck me was that Kira and Odo are taking a practical view of the situation that they are in. They're facing the reality of what's happening in the moment, and Jake is taking an idealistic view of what's going on. And I felt like Jake is representing the Star Trek ideal. You know, the Roddenberry vision that in the future everything is going to be better, and it's not turning out that way. And Kira and Odo, they both were there during the occupation, and of course Kira had fought the Cardassians, and Odo knows what it's like to work on the station under the Cardassians in the past. And because of the experience that they've both had, they're able to look at the situation and see what's happening here and now, how should I deal with it, and what steps should I take to try to get a favorable outcome? Whereas Jake is just, you know, everyone needs to have the freedom of speech and the freedom to gather. And he just seems to be taking the position that we see even in our own world when we're dealing with youth versus experience. You know, young people still have very idealistic views. And as we get older, we become a bit jaded. But we also are able to see more sides of an issue.
See, that's really interesting because I didn't take that whole storyline like that at all. What I was seeing in the episode was the fact that Kira and Odo have been doing this for so long in the storyline that they've just kind of gotten numb or comfortable where they are. In the same way that if somebody hears a lie enough, they start to believe it, you know, as the truth.
You're talking about George Costanza again?
You people say things enough, and whether or not they're actually true, people start to believe them. And I feel like that's almost kind of what's been happening to Kira and Odo, is that they've been kind of lulled into this. I was just watching Star Trek VI. After being lulled into a false sense of security by Captain Kirk and his officers aboard the Enterprise. But I feel like that's what's kind of happening, and you see that in the episode of Kira. Just, she gets up every day, she gets her coffee from the Cardassian, they go about their business, she's lost that fire that she did have as a youth. A young Bajoran girl who wasn't going to allow the Cardassians to take any more of her home. So really just kind of what I saw was that whole idea of it, sometimes it's just easy for us to get complacent, and when situations are horrible and we don't agree with them, we just kind of let them go. You know, it reminded me very much of, you know, the people in, like, say, Germany during World War II, who didn't agree with Hitler, but they damn sure weren't going to stand up against it.
Well, I think today a good analogy to that would be somewhere like North Korea, for example, or even China, where especially China with the youth, maybe they want something different,
right?
But they're not going to stand up
right.
to the Communist
right.
Party.
And not obviously that I don't, you know, Kira and Odo, when they finally are kind of awakened, they're not going to go about this, I think the way that with demonstrations and things like that, they're going to form a resistance and they're going to do it as underhanded from the Dominion as possible so that they're not putting as many lives at stake. You know, they understand how to do this in a way that, you know, others might not. And so I think that's the big difference here is they're going to work smartly and do as much damage as possible. But at the same time, they're obviously going to try and keep as many people, you know, especially innocent people, safe. And so, I think that's where that real experience from those two really come in. And will obviously come in the rest of this series.
But the thing is, at the beginning, I don't get the feeling that there's any sense of urgency, certainly, or really any movement on the part of Kira and Odo to form any kind of resistance or take any sort of action. They're very complacent with this is the situation as it is right now, and this is what we need to do. And what's happening, of course, is that this group of facilitators from the Dominion are going to be going down to Bajor. And Kira's explanation to Jake thinking this is a bad idea, she says, since the war started, Bajor has been completely cut off from all outside trade. We have nowhere to turn for things like spare parts and medical supplies, nowhere except the Dominion. So a group of facilitators is going to Bajor for a few months to provide technical assistance. And surely in the back of her mind, she's thinking, well, this is how it starts. You know, a group of facilitators come, and that's the first step towards us being occupied by the Dominion. But she's still going to allow this to take place and sees it as a necessary step. And that is what I mean by her facing the reality, seeing what it is right now and what she needs to do to maybe eventually get a favorable outcome. And also probably because of her background fighting in the resistance to the Cardassian occupation, she doesn't want to take that same approach this time. Maybe she's older, she's wiser, and she is going to look for a less violent solution.
Yeah, I think to me it just plays off way more that Kira has lost her way, and it's through Jake and through this Vedic Yasim that she's reminded that she has become what she hated in the occupation.
Oh, as the episode goes on, yeah, absolutely.
It's a collaborate. Yeah. But I mean, you think that's the, like, them setting that up of they're not really facing reality. They're not facing anything. They're just going along with the program, like, as if this is just your normal daily news. You know, this is what happens. You know, that Kira, I feel like she just, her and Odo have really lost something in this, and it takes them being reminded of that fire that they should
right.
have.
Well, Jake asks Odo, do you have any concerns that by joining the ruling council here on the station, you're validating the occupation? And Odo says, the Dominion doesn't need my validation. They're here and they're not leaving. Not without a fight anyway.
Right.
But I mean, that's the reality too, though. They understand what the actual situation
right.
is. Where I just feel like Jake is the voice of traditional Star Trek here. Jake is the voice of, you know, you should do this and you should do that and you shouldn't allow this because that doesn't fit into the better future vision. It's very idealistic, and it's easy to say those things. It's much harder to actually do them.
Yeah, I guess part of it, we're saying kind of the same thing Yeah, I'm still seeing it differently from you in that.
Sure.
I think that Odo and Kira, they're not using their positions that they have. They're not even thinking about it at this point. Okay, how do we start the resistance? Yeah, yeah, yeah. How do we do all this? Yeah. Because they have become comfortable with where they are and thinking that they're doing all they can. And yet we know, as the audience, that they're not. Because we know who Kira used to be and that she would hate herself now if she saw herself, which is why they keep having her look in the mirror every morning. Yeah. And so that it's only on that next morning when she wakes up after Yasim has killed herself that she can't stand to look at herself.
Yeah, right. Which is why the first scene, the time is 0500 hours, has to exist at the beginning of the episode, because that scene feels, when you watch through the first time, that scene feels so out of place, because everything's happening on this planet. They cut back to the station, and then they cut back to the planet. And there's just that little bit in there of her waking up, going through her morning routine, and it feels out of place. But when you get to the end of the episode, when it happens the second time, then it's clear why it has to exist at the beginning, because you can't set up the second occurrence and pay it off without it happening the first time. But it feels odd the first time.
Yeah, because they're setting up that sense of inevitability. Like Odo says, they don't need validation, but I think more along the lines of, too, is Jake isn't hearing them tell him, we're using our positions for a greater good. You know,
because they're not.
They're just towing the party line at this point. They are collaborators, and it's to see them go from where they were. And Jake knows this, too. I mean, he knows who Kira is. He knows who Odo is, what they've been through. You know, they've been living in the station for 6 years together.
But Jake is, at this point, I mean, he's still a teenager. He may know that, but I think that the views of youth and the idealistic views that he has and the story he's searching for don't allow him to fully take that into account, what he knows about Kira.
I would say that if Jake isn't about to be an important part of the resistance in the rest of this series, like the rest of this this arc, he's going to be really important.
Sure.
And so that's,
but again, I think that what happens leads him to that, just like I think by the end of this episode we see Kira change, but we don't really see that at the beginning. So for Jake, what comes next also changes him.
Yeah, it's a possibility. So I guess I always just saw it more, even the first time, is that Jake is part of that waking up for Kira and Odo. Because I think really what he represents is Kira and Odo, you know, 20 years ago. Well, especially Kira.
Yeah.
He represents that Kira who was that age and fighting the Cardassians.
Yeah,
and she's face to face with somebody who's basically saying the things that young Kira would say to her. You know, he's just being more diplomatic and kind with the way he's phrasing the questions. But basically,
I mean, he's not shouting and pounding control panels like Kira would have.
There's your wormhole! No, but
there's your facilitators!
Exactly. But no, I just really see that, you know, Jake is diplomatically asking them questions. As you said, I'm just writing this story. But at the same time, they're I think using him as just one of those key points, to one of those touchstones on Kira's path to figuring out I'm not who I want to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I agree on that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And yeah, but I think you're right. I think all of this is set up to really move all of these characters on the station, especially, you know, Kira, Odo, and Jake at that point, it's going to be Kira and Jake, strangely enough, because Odo's going to be shacking up with, you know, the founder chick. So, you know, it's strange.
Sounds like a show title right there, Matthew.
shacking up with
the founder chick.
But just think about that. Of that three, you would think it would be Kira and Odo that would be the main resistance force. And really, it becomes Kira and Jake because they're the ones who are trying to figure everything out when Odo isn't around anymore. And so, yeah, you're right that they are using all of this to really build a fantastic story for these characters. And as we've talked on the show before, you know, who would have thought that Jake would kind of become this character? And what I really love in this episode is that I think they've done a fantastic job of creating a character that's not based in Starfleet. He's based in the Federation, though, and he still has those ideals, but he is living a completely different life. And it is really interesting to watch that play out because it's not something that we've really seen before on Star Trek.
Well, I think that also reflects the Roddenberry ideals of the future through the average person, not through the military.
Right, yes, yes. Yeah. And even though, is it really a military? Yes, Starfleet's a military organization. I mean,
it is,
their mission may be always been one of peace, as Spock says in Star Trek VI, but they're also for protection. They walk softly and carry a big stick. So basically, apparently, they're just Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, let's talk about one other thing here, which, I mean, it plays into this. A lot of what we talk about here, it's a thread that runs through, but loyalties are tested in this episode amongst many different people. And, of course, what we've been talking about right here are testing Kira's loyalties to her faith and to her people. Also, Odo's loyalties, which we always question where those lie. We've talked about that many times on the show here, whether Odo truly is loyal to the Bajorans or to Starfleet, or does he become loyal to whoever is in power at that time? At this point in his life, I don't think that's the case, but in the past, when he was working under the Cardassians on the station, I think maybe that was true, and then he quickly adapted to Starfleet. But we also see other things here. One that I find very interesting is digging into what's going on inside the Dominion with the Vorta and the Jem'Hadar and where the loyalties lie there, because the Jem'Hadar are, I would say they're loyal to the Vorta because the Vorta controls them, but actually I think the dialogue in this episode shows that that's not the case. They're loyal to the Founders. They just obey the Vorta because that is the order of things.
Yeah, it is a really interesting thing in this episode to watch, especially the Jem'Hadar and their honor-bound system, their built-in system of honor that keeps them loyal to a fault to the Founders and their order of things. And they don't seem to have the reasoning, cognitive abilities to be able to make the leap that it's really not all that honorable to be loyal to, say, somebody like this Vorta in this episode, who's just the slimiest sleazeball ever.
Yeah. But you say that, but on the other hand, I take something else away from this episode, something different, which is, in this episode, once again, we have Jackie Chiles from Seinfeld, Phil Morris. We talked about him recently, both here and on the Ready Room, because he plays the Klingon in Looking for Parmok in All the Wrong Places. But here he plays Ramata Klein, the third, the Jem'Hadar who actually talks to Sisko. And I get the feeling that they do have the cognitive abilities that you mentioned, but they're unwilling to take that next step to actually defy the Vorta. I think that Phil Morris does a really good job in this episode of portraying a Jem'Hadar who does understand the situation, and you can see the gears turning in his head, but he, from the time he was conceived, which he says specifically, he has been loyal to the Vorta and to the Founders. And so he's not going, no matter what Sisko says to him, and no matter how much it makes sense to him, he's not going to take that step to actually defy them. But they do, I think, have the cognitive ability to, at least some of them do, anyway.
Yeah. I was just thinking about my stupidity in that statement.
I don't think it's a stupid statement, because the Jem'Hadar are portrayed as being these ruthless killing machines, mm-hmm. but the nuance of what we get in this mm-hmm. story and some of the other writing onward in DS9 shows us that you shouldn't judge that book by its cover, right?
I was also thinking of the episode with Bashir and Miles, where they are, you know, asked to cure the rest of these Jem'Hadar, you know, and those are definitely Jem'Hadar that were willing to go against the order of things as well. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there are those select few. It reminds me of Star Wars, the Clone Wars, where you have those clones who become much more than they were intended to be because of the influence of the Jedi, and they're even willing to question and turn their back on their training, and that's basically what they are. They're trained soldiers and killers, and yet there are a few of them out there who, you know, desert and go start families, you know. So, yeah, that I think that fits in really well here, that this is just a Jem'Hadar who can't completely make that turn, even though he's probably one of the wisest Jem'Hadar that we've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's a great conversation between him and Sisko, where Sisko talks about how, you know, he's worked with the Jem'Hadar before. And I don't think he's just putting this Jem'Hadar on. I think he really believes that the men that he worked with were pretty honor bound and loyal and all those things, and he's just kind of dealt with enough Vorta to see that they really are just like the used car salesman of the galaxy. I mean, just willing to rip you off at any moment, any time. I mean, I feel like they're worse than Ferengi at that point, because the Ferengi, you know what you're getting. The Vorta, gosh, you never know what you're going to get. I mean, it could be Iggy Pop.
Right. You might really get him.
Exactly.
Yeah, this Vorta is... Initially, I'm thinking, I don't like this Vorta. I don't like the casting, because there's something about the smile, there's something about the eyes of Kivan as he's lying there injured, and the way he delivers the lines. But by the end of the episode, I feel like this was actually really well thought out, because he's so creepy and so slimy and so untrustworthy all the way through, even before he meets Sisko and lays out his terms, that it really pays off at the end when he walks across the quarry that, yeah, like you said, and no offense to anyone listening who is a used car salesman, but you know the reputation of that industry. You get that feeling like it's always some sort of shady deal going on.
And you're really kind of wishing that Sisko would just shoot him in the end, aren't we? I mean, even Sisko
wanted to.
Yeah.
He really
he
wanted
did.
To.
And
this is the thing. If they had any other way to get off that planet, if they did not need that communications device, and of course they could have just gone and taken it anyway, but I really think Sisko probably would have shot him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it was because too of the respect that, you know, the Jem'Hadar and him have for one another. Sisko, they're warriors on the battlefield. They're coming together under the engagement rules of warfare. You know, they are fighting honorably against one another for what they believe in, and so they can both respect that. And yet this Vorta is using this battle for his own gain and just willingly throwing wives away for no good reason other than his own safety. And, you know, obviously that is against everything that Sisko and the Federation stand for. And it's so interesting to watch, you know, our characters have to use that to get out of the situation, because it's one of those... it's one of those small steps that Sisko's making, I think, in some ways, towards getting to a pale moonlight.
Yeah. What's interesting, too, is so the Vorta will throw away these lives, I think, because to the Vorta, the Jem'Hadar aren't people. They're not living beings in any sense that they should have their own rights or their own life. They're merely tools for the Dominion, and so dispensing of them, it's not to them like they're actually dispensing of living beings. And what's interesting in that sense is that I think that the Federation, and especially Sisko, has a lot more respect for the Jem'Hadar than the Dominion itself does. The Jem'Hadar are Dominion citizens and really the guardians of the Dominion. And yet they have, they're seen as nothing more than tools for conquest. And Sisko actually sees them as living beings who can make decisions, and maybe you can reason with them.
Yeah, I mean,
and doesn't want to kill them.
Yes,
because he tells them at the end, like, it's pointless for us to fight a battle under these conditions. So let's walk away from this.
Yeah, again, I think it's a very much like the Jedi with the clones. They treat them as beings with, you know, basically they're souled beings. They deserve to be treated as such. They deserve to be given names, you know, and all of that. Whereas Jem'Hadar, it's just the first, second, third. You know, that's how the Vorta know them. They don't call them by name often.
Even there's no first and there's no second, and he still will not actually promote the third to the first.
Right, because he's holding a ridiculous grudge because he questioned his orders. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was interesting to see where the loyalties lie there, in the fact that I think this episode helps shine some light on the Jem'Hadar as beings, right? Not just fighting machines. And yet they're so loyal to the Dominion. You can tell that the Jem'Hadar don't like the Vorta, right? You can tell.
Right.
But because it's the order of things, they're going to blindly follow, even when they know that they're being set up. So in that sense, they're completely loyal, at least to the founders.
And it's not quite a blind loyalty, because they're not oblivious to what's actually happening.
They're silently questioning, but yes, they won't say anything.
But, you know, and I think that's interesting too, because there's no honor in that. In the end, you know, I think they're doing it because they think they're following the right way laid down by the founders, and yet there's really no actual honor in that. There's no furthering the Dominion by them dying at this point in this episode, you know, because really what Sisko was giving that opportunity was to live on and maybe fight another day, but that's what they can't see. Is that kind of, I think, that kind of forward thinking. You know, there's always a possibility, and they are a little bit limited. They think two-dimensionally, like Khan, and not three-dimensionally.
So, I was going to say, so they're like Khan.
Yeah. But yeah, it really is, because this episode does a great job, I think, too, of exploring the facets of the Dominion. And it's basically lower ranks. What's it like, you know, to be in the rank and file on both sides? Again, it's a very interesting and almost kind of introspective look at the idea of war and what it's really doing to these people on each side, and how it may or may not make them question their own order of things.
Well, let's talk about Kira a little bit more. This is the other thing I wanted to touch on, and we talked about this a bit already, but when she finally comes to what I call Kira's awakening, after Vedic Yassim hangs herself, Kira realizes that she has lost herself in this new reality around her, and that she really needs to do something. And she thinks back, and she says, "We used to have a saying in the Resistance, if you're not fighting them, you're helping them." And she realizes that by going about her job there on the station, by waking up every morning at 0500 hours, riding the lift with that menagerie of Cardassians, the Jem'Hadar, and everyone who's on there, and getting her coffee from a Cardassian, that she's facilitating their takeover of the Alpha Quadrant. And that she really needs to do something. And she mentions how she hated people like her when she was younger and she was in the Resistance.
Yeah, I love this part of the story, because I think it, again, what they're doing is they're turning everything on its head and creating more interesting storylines. You know, because Kira would have never been like this if it had not been for the years, I think, that she had spent on the station and kind of living a more peaceful life. And it has kind of dulled her senses just a little bit to what's kind of going on around her. Because, you know, Quark does say, and it's true, does this occupation look that bad to you? This isn't the occupation that was, you know, what happened the first time. You know, 50 years under the Cardassians in labor camps and all of those things under a totalitarian rule. And so it has been much easier to let that slide. And yet what's great about this episode is I think it's Jake, and I think this Vedic Yassim, you know, in her hanging herself, really lead her to see that it's not that different. Because if the Jem'Hadar and the Dominion win, this is going to be way worse than the Cardassian occupation ever was. It just looks pretty right now.
Yeah.
But wait till it's over and we don't have a choice.
The Vedic killing herself, hanging herself, represents that the feeling is that this is the end of our way of life, right? Mm-hmm. This is the end of our life. And
it's the end of the world as they know it.
Right. And Kira does not feel fine. So, but yeah, I mean, it's that visual, like, in this situation, Kira needed to actually see that in order for it to occur to her what the Vedic was trying to tell her in the first place.
Well, yeah, I think she's emotionally slapped is what happens.
Right, yeah,
She's slapped out of the malaise that she's been in because of what happens.
Because what Vedic Yassim is telling her earlier in the episode is, I mean, I'm not going to say I agree with everything that she's saying or everything that anyone is saying, because there's a lot going on here and there are a lot of things that you have to take into consideration if you're going to deal with that situation. But Kira just doesn't want to hear what she's being told early in the episode. And the only way to get through was, the only way for Vedic Yassim to get through was to do something like this.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing, too, that it would take something so jarring and so disturbing to really wake Kira up. But I think that the reality of that situation is that that's what happens in a lot of places, for us to be kind of snapped out of things.
Yeah, it does.
Something really terrible has to happen a lot of times, which is so unfortunate that we can be so blind. I mean, it's just the reality, I think, of being human. And again, we get comfortable, I think, in our situations that we can't see what's right in front of our faces without it kind of blowing up.
And if it doesn't affect you on a personal level, then you're less likely to take action. And in Kira's case, you know, she said she eats a full meal every day. She sleeps in a soft bed.
Are those Cardassian beds really that soft? They've never looked soft to me.
Well, she's got her special one, you know. She's got the one.
Oh, she's got the one with the Tempur-Pedic on top?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's from the Kindra province. They make really good mattresses there, apparently.
Yeah, they really do. Very soft.
That all Kindra goose down. It's really fluffy.
Yeah, it's terrible, though, when they're migrating in. The sound is just terrible. And there is goose poop everywhere.
That is not going to be the show title, Matthew. Although it might well describe the situation that the Federation is finding itself in right now.
Man, we're in a bunch of goose poop now. And I'm from Texas, so I can say that.
All right. So, yeah, but seeing Kira wake up, it was interesting. And then Odo also wakes up here as a result of this as well. And as you mentioned earlier on, Jake, this is the beginning of a transition for Jake, which will lead to him and Kira being the planners of the resistance more so than anyone else as we go along. Although we get everyone involved eventually, right? I mean, we've got Quark involved, we've got Rom involved. Yeah. Everyone is there.
Yeah, everybody. What's great is that, you know, it's a couple of main characters, really, and then all these great side characters that come in And that's the beauty of them having spent enough time on them, so you'll care when they're involved in something like this. It's really masterful writing, and I know that it wasn't all on purpose the entire show, but they just were smart enough to put pieces on the board that so that when they need them, they can move them that way. And it just makes sense for the storylines.
That's why Ducat and Wayun learned to fear the SCA, the side character army.
I thought they were going to be some kind of chess club or something. But
all right. So one last thing here to wrap up. It just occurs to me at the end of the episode when you look back at what happened through the episode, because I feel like this is sort of an unusual episode, the way the story is told, because we're constantly cutting back and forth between the planet and the station and the planet and the station. And the cuts are not as clean as you're accustomed to in Star Trek, I feel. Like, we get these quicker cuts to action that's happening in two places, which makes me feel also like you could look at this story and think that Sisko and the Jem'Hadar and the Vorta on the planet is the A story, and then Kira and Odo and Vedic Yassim back on the station is the B story. But I actually feel like it's all one A story that's interweaved between two separate locations with two separate groups of people. Because what's happening each time you cut back and forth is really supporting the message of what's happening in the other place. And ultimately, the episode for me is all about questioning. You know, the Jem'Hadar say it is the order of things. And Kira and Odo, at the beginning when they're talking to Jake, I feel that they are also saying it is the order of things. But Jake questions them, and Sisko questions the Jem'Hadar. And by the end of the episode, some people have changed their views and their positions. Some people have stubbornly held on, in the case of the Jem'Hadar. But all the way through, we're just really, really questioning our place and our role in what's happening.
It seemed to me as well that as we were watching the episode, it was war happens on many fronts, and that's what this was really kind of driving home, is that war doesn't just take place on a battlefield or with crashed ships or, you know, with people shooting at each other. War also happens like it is back on the station. And it starts with fighting against that complacency and that idea that this is just the way things are, and finding a way to, you know, fight back. And so I really like that in this episode, and I think it does make it a special episode. And I think the other thing that's jarring is that you're going from the darker station to the very bright, usually outside.
And you're going back and forth.
Right. And so that makes it seem stranger. And yet, I think it's very, very well told when we're looking at the episode as a whole. And what's great is just the way that, you know, they're weaving it all together, as I talked about. You know, the frustration, the humor, that's playing out on all sides of this story, too. Whether it's on the station or there on the planet, all of it's kind of working together to show that, you know, war is messy, and it has a way of kind of messing with people,
and it's complex.
Exactly. It's not cut and dry. It's not black and white. It's none of those things, because especially, you know, here on this planet, if Sisko didn't have to kill these Jem'Hadar, he wasn't going to, you know. And if it was just a black and white universe here, we would say, oh, no, you just kill them. They're the bad guys, you know, but yeah. That's not what we're saying here. And I think that's a really great thing to see, because, again, that's the Star Trek nuance. That's that's the fact that the universe is not just cut and dry. It's none of those things. It's not black and white like that all the time. Yes, there's evil. Yes, there's good. But there's in between, too. And we, being a really reasoned and enlightened person, is being able to know the difference between the two.
Yeah. Yeah, what struck me before they head out for the final confrontation, and everyone is giving their opinion, and Sisko says, this is not a vote. And then he agrees with Garak, and he says, given the choice between us and them, there is no choice. And I think that in that situation, for me, it's easy to understand Sisko's position, yet it also struck me that it's counterintuitive to Star Trek. Like, I feel like the Star Trek ideals would be that there is a solution. But as Sisko says, we're at war, and there really isn't a choice here. You know, either it's them or it's us. And even at the end, he still tries to find a way, but ultimately, he has to make the decision to strike them all down.
Yeah, it really it brings to mind to me, you know, kind of the superhero dilemma. Do I not kill the bad guy, but then he's going to get, you know, out again and cause more mayhem, kill more people, you know? So that those Star Trek ideals, there's always another way.
Yeah.
But there isn't always another way. And the same right. thing with, I think, in the superhero genre, there really isn't always another better way. Because, yeah, wouldn't it have been better if the Joker had just been killed by Batman years ago?
Yeah, but then Batman would be out of a job, Matthew.
Isn't that kind of the point of Batman? I mean, I don't want to get off on this too far, but you know what I'm saying? Like, there is a point where there the option of it's them or us, you know, there isn't a better way. There isn't a better way out of this situation. The hand we've been dealt here. Yeah, I think that's another great, interesting question. And only Deep Space Nine, I feel like, really asks that question and doesn't give you any kind of easy answer.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to give you a big reset button like Voyager does. It's going to make it sit there uncomfortably for the rest of the series.
Right. All right. Well, this is Rocks and Shoals. So next time we're going to continue. Well, the next time we continue the series, we'll be talking about Sons and Daughters. Of course, we'll have some other Orb episodes in between there, as we always do, including an Orb of Mail coming up soon, because we've been getting some great feedback from you guys. And on this show, we save them up for those special episodes. So stay tuned for that. But Rocks and Shoals and the Dominion Invasion isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network recently. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
They look at the dailies the next day, and Bill Shatner crossed his eyes intentionally. Crossed his eyes on a close-up because the camera could see his face even though they couldn't. So the take was totally unusable.
Earl Grey.
Again, you know, because it's January, my ship was shot beyond the bounds of normal interstellar travel to the center of the galaxy, but we were back in time for tea.
The Orb.
Curzon is involved with the Kittimer yep. Quartz. Spock is at Kittimer when those are being talked about, so you would think they would have run into each other.
They probably
at least.
Hung out in the bar together.
To the journey!
Yeah, Harry, what is he doing in the mirror universe? Okay, he's got a goatee, for sure.
He's got a goatee. He's got long hair.
Yeah, I love Garrett Wong, Wong, like 2008.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
The Ready Room.
I think of all the shows that people think of with Star Trek, I don't think anybody would have thought that Deep Space Nine would be the one to do a romantic comedy.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
But I mean, here's the question, John. If you're living Fight Club, then, you know, we have to ask. If you could fight anyone, who would you fight?
William Shatner.
All right.
Literary Treks.
Dan, one of the things that you mentioned here in the outline was just that our heroes are real people. And even sometimes in the novels for TOS, I feel like we kind of forget this.
The 602 Club.
Well, I've been always drawn to anything dealing with Arthurian legend or knights or dragons. And then having the plus of Dennis Quaid and the voice of Sean Connery, can't get enough of that, ever.
No. No, not at all. Even if it's coming from a dragon.
Hey, that works for me.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what else we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. We're in iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. You can go to the website and stream, download the MP3 file, grab the RSS feed. You can get us everywhere that you get audio. And while you're there in iTunes, please take a moment and leave us a star rating and a written review. That makes a big difference in how easy it is for other Deep Space Nine fans to find the Orb as they're searching the iTunes store. And plus, we just love to hear what you think about the show. And Matthew, speaking of how people can share their thoughts on the show, I think the Babel Conference is probably the best place. So tell people what that is.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I really love the fact that on the Babel Conference, we get the opportunity to really engage with you guys. And the ideas that you bring up are just fantastic. In fact, we were actually having a great discussion earlier about Cardassians because of an article that Will had written. And some of the ideas that we were talking about, I was like, this would make a great Orb show, just the idea of talking about, are Cardassians the best race in Star Trek, the most, you know, nuanced? And so, yeah, okay. I think just really fantastic. So if that's the kind of conversation that you enjoy, the Babel Conference is the place for you. So come on over to Facebook and join, because why ain't you joined yet?
Right. And the way you join is to just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. Click join, and we'll let you right on in there. Or on our website, you can click discussion up on the menu bar, and that will take you over there as well. Now, other ways that you can get in touch with us are on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. Of course, we have our regular Facebook page, facebook.com/TrekFM. And you can also send us email by going to the website, trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose the Orb. And that'll come to both Matthew and me by email. And you can even go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM and send us a voicemail using just your smartphone, tablet, or your computer. And you can upload it there from the page. So we'd love to hear your voice as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not helping Jake smuggle his latest news story out of Dominion space, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and comics of Star Trek. And so if you enjoy some of the Deep Space Nine talk we have here, we have tons of that there with Deep Space Nine books and comics and all sorts of stuff. And of course, I do the 602 Club. We just pick a great geeky topic each week and talk about that. So whether it's something like Indiana Jones or something like that, I hope you'll join us there. And then, of course, my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not waking up in the morning and seeing yourself in the mirror and not quite sure you like what you see, where can we find you?
Oh, still with the cameras hidden all around my house, Matthew, I told you. You're spying on me in the mornings now, I see. All right. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. I'm also on Facebook. You'll find me there in the Babel Conference, commenting on posts from time to time. And you can find me on my personal website, cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, you'll find me doing the Ready Room with other hosts from all around the network and special guests as we rotate through all 5 live-action Star Trek series and occasionally do a special topic as well. And I also sometimes do Hyperchannel, which is a quick take on news from the Star Trek universe. So check out those shows if you want to hear more of my voice and what I think about the world of Star Trek. Lastly, Matthew, before we go, we do want to give a shout out to our associate producers here on The Orb, Norm Lau, Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, and Ken Tripp. They help us keep the show coming to you guys every week, so please give them a shout out. I think they're all there in the Babel Conference, in fact, so that's a great way to get in touch with them and tell them thank you for their support and helping The Orb get produced for you guys every week, or almost every week here on the network. We really thank them for their support, and we hope that you will support us as well. And one way you can do that is to go to patreon.com/trekfm and check out the perks and the levels, and you can contribute any amount that you like there. We are a listener-supported network, and so we do appreciate any support that you can give us there at patreon.com/trekfm.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us. And we'll see you next time as we gaze into the Orb.